But I'm not going to read it all. I'm going to read. If you need a Bible, there are some in the back, or you can pull it up on your phone. I'll try to give you verse numbers as I'm. This is a story. Now, as we've worked our way through this series, we've kind of hit these high points. And as I've said over and over again, kind of talking through here, you know, this is one big story of God bringing about restoration. That's what we have in the Bible. And our main passages have been children's storybook material. You know, Adam and Eve, we've had Noah and the flood and Abraham, where God says, okay, Abraham, we're going to start this project, right, of building something new. We're going to start it with you. We talked about Moses, and of course, let's not forget, we sang it earlier. God comes and he says, I brought you up on wings like eagles. I rescued you. I pulled you out. Now obey me. Remember, grace came first. So we talked about that part. We talked about David and the establishment of a king. That was important. I mean, these are all like high moments in this story and significant developments. So the story that we're going to look at today, actually sort of two stories, two generations, two different stories. But this is not what you would find in a children's storybook Bible. A lot of children's storybook Bibles, as you guys have heard me say, like to tell the moral tale. You know, this is why you should be good. There's no way even to begin to manipulate our story today and to see how good these wonderful people were. These are absolute failures. This is a failure of leadership and worship and a failure in covenant history. But here's what we can learn from it. I'm just going to give you this right off the bat, that God doesn't give up. And so that's why I think it's important for us to look at this. These are all of these stories that we get in the Bible are like family stories, right? You know, we all have our stories in our families. We might have stories of our grandparents or our great-grandparents pioneering North Dakota, coming over from Germany or Norway or whatever. And these might be some of the family stories, and these stories shape us. They shape how we respond to things, how we understand things. Some of these stories we don't want to repeat. Some are, oh yeah, I remember when that happened. But they all sort of define the way that we view the world. This is one of those stories that we don't necessarily like, but it's a family story, and it's a part of, I think, a part of our identity. In fact, I'd argue that these stories should shape us, who we are, how we see the world, how we interact with the world. These stories should shape us more than those different stories of our different heritages or our own family stories. These are the real family stories. When Jesus adopts us, he says, no, 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 you're no longer that, now you're this, and this is what we are. So that's sort of the context, that's where we're going. So, this is going to be a little different. I'm going to tell you a story. Well, look, I'll highlight certain verses. We'll talk about it as we go through. But then, toward the end, we'll ask the question, so what? What do we learn from it? So, bear with me as we do something a little different. It all starts, I'm going to read 11:1. It all starts here. Now, usually when a Bible verse starts with now, you should pay attention. Now King Solomon loved many foreign women, along with the daughter of Pharaoh, Moabite, Ammonite, Edomite, Sidonian, and Hittite women. This is the important verse. Concerning the nations which the Lord had said to the people of Israel, you shall not intermarriage with them. See, we're supposed to be clued in here. Right away, we're supposed to be noticing, wait a minute, Solomon did something that God said don't do, and he did a lot. And he goes on toward the end of verse 3, his wives turned away his heart. For when Solomon was old, his wives turned away his heart after other gods, and his heart was not wholly true to the Lord his God, as was the heart of David his father. You know, I think it's interesting. We should be clued in now, right? We've read just a few verses, and we should recognize that the author is telling us that Solomon has not done what he was supposed to. God said, don't marry these women, and he did. But then what's really interesting, we talk about this sometimes. You know, this is one of these examples. How can you have, I hear people, there's a guy in here that had 300 wives. How did he believe all that stuff? And he's supposed to be a hero of the Bible, right? Well, I think we just found out that he's not supposed to be a hero of the Bible. That's your first clue there. But what's pointed out as his main failure is that his heart turned away from God. It's not, I mean, we can understand that one of his problems was the wives, but the real problem was worship. His real problem was that he chose to worship other gods. Now, I do think it's interesting that it's pointed out, as was the heart of David, his father. We've read about David. Most of you know about David. He committed murder and adultery. So I just think it's worth pointing out that a generation later, we're still told that David's heart was after God. So because of all this, because Solomon chose to turn away from God, God decides to take the kingdom away from him. Now remember, Solomon had inherited 12 different tribes, different groups of people. They were all part of this kingdom. He had inherited them from his father. And God decides, I'm going to change that because I don't want people worshiping all of these different gods. It's interesting, the king in Israel, we've kind of talked a little bit about this, the king in Israel was supposed to be different from other kings. The kings all around were almost gods. In many cases they were, or they were one of the gods of the nation. Here, the king is told to be a servant, and rather than to sort of be over the people, point, his main job, his primary duty was not government. It was worship. It was to point the people to the one true God. And Solomon hasn't done that. And so God says, no, 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 we're going to tear this kingdom apart because you won't. The Lord was angry with Solomon because his heart had turned away from the Lord, the God of Israel, who had appeared to him twice and had commanded him concerning this thing, that he should not go after other gods. God shows up twice. He says, don't do it. And he does it. And so God's angry. And he says, I'm going to raise up enemies. It's interesting that in this process, as he's getting ready to take the kingdom away, as he's getting ready to do it, he says, but for the sake of David, I'm not going to do it in his lifetime. I'm going to do it in his children's. See that? Solomon messed up. Solomon's not going to pay the price. His kids are going to pay the price. The Bible has a strong view of generational faithfulness. This is one reason I stress coming and bringing kids to church on a regular basis. We talk about this sometimes as staff. As a staff, we talk about the importance of faithfulness to a community of worship, of showing our kids that, of being that for our kids. There is a, I mean, if you haven't seen the statistics, your Facebook timeline just looks different than mine. But there are trends in our culture of declining church attendance. And I see it. I see it starts with church regularity, right? It's a generation ago, I know the stories. I talk to people. I know this. I grew up in this. But maybe not to this extreme. A generation ago, I know people would, if you were on vacation, you found a church if it was Sunday, right? Now, I'll confess, I don't necessarily find a church on Sunday if I'm on vacation. But now, if you feel like sleeping in, you just don't go. That's the case for many of us, often. And here's what I think we can see here with this generational view, and I can see it. I can see it playing out, is that when we kind of, I don't feel like going that today, it's our grandchildren who are going to suffer. I read a post, I think I shared, I posted it on Facebook yesterday, it's a quote. It said that Christians need to stop seeing church as an option on Sunday morning, but rather as the front line of a war for cultural restoration. And I think it's important that we understand that. Because the less serious we take worship of God, the less serious our grandchildren will. And as that declines, everything changes. So I think that's an important thing to understand. And I think it's also worth noting that the primary emphasis should be on worship, not on comfort, security, ease, the way I like it to be, the way we've always done it, but worship. Anything else would be self-centered. Now, here's another thing that's interesting, and it goes back to this generational view. We're told in chapter 11 of three different adversaries that are raised up against Solomon during this time. Hadad and Rezon are two of them. And the examples, the reasons that these guys have become adversaries are laid out here in the story. And in both these cases, it's things that David did. Both stories are told, and David chose to do something that was a bad idea at the time, probably, and this person is then raised up and comes back to attack his son. Now, I get two things out of that. First of all, Solomon had a chance to avoid his father's problems. All he had to do was worship. All he had to do was choose to worship God and God alone. This might not have happened, but his dad's problems come back to haunt him. That makes me think, men, us, me, Jared, are our children, let's be honest, what are the problems that are likely to haunt my children because of me? I mean, that's the first. The other is, what are the problems from a generation back that have caused me a problem? And how do I own that, deal with it, be honest about it, and then overcome it? Or do I propagate the problem down another generation? I think most of us are prone to, I know we are, if we don't do anything, it only propagates it forward. But if we choose to worship God and God alone, I think we can begin to grow past that. And I certainly think it's worth asking the question, what are my problems that are likely going to haunt my children and my grandchildren when I'm gone? I think we need to be honest about it. Then there's this other adversary that's raised up against Solomon. His name is Jeroboam. That's one of the most more important names. We're going to hear his name a little bit more. Hang on to that one. He shows up in verse 26. And God intentionally raises up Jeroboam to be the leader who replaces Solomon. The idea is God says, I'm going to split the kingdom. The kingdom is going to be divided. And Jeroboam's going to be king of 10 tribes. And Solomon's son will be king of 2. But then it's interesting. I love this, and I'm going to point it out to you because we're going to see this later. As God is talking to Jeroboam, it shows up in verse 38. He says, and if you will listen, he's talking to Jeroboam now, future king of Israel, and if you will listen to all that I command you and will walk in my ways and do what is right in my eyes by keeping my statutes and my commandments as David my servant did, I will be with you. And I will build you a sure house as I built for David, and I will give Israel to you. This is the promise. I'm going to point that out because we're going to see that again in a minute. And then, toward the end, we're told Rehoboam, his son, Solomon's son, reigned in his place. So, Solomon's dead at this point. This is what happened. Toward the end of his life. Now, I like to think, we don't know, we can only speculate, but I like to think that the book of Ecclesiastes was written after some of this stuff happened. As Solomon is on his deathbed, or near it, I think he starts to wise up, because if you read that book, and it's one of these days we're going to do a sermon series on Ecclesiastes, because I really enjoy it. The whole point of the book is, look, I've done it all, I've seen it all, I've had it all, and it's all pointless. Worshiping God, obeying God, loving God, that's pretty much all there is. Everything else, it's not gonna help, it's not gonna make me happy, it's not gonna fulfill me. Whatever I'm looking for in all these places, it's not there. And I think Solomon figured it out when it was a little bit too late. I don't want us to. Keep from idols. It's interesting. That's what I would say the point of this is. If we can draw any kind of application, stay away from idols. First John, we talked about that a while back. A whole letter, John, the apostle that Jesus loved, wrote a whole letter to churches, and he's telling them how to live and how to walk with God for a lifetime and all of these things. And the last sentence that he wrote to them seems completely out of context in its place. Little children, keep yourself from idols. If there is anything more significant to walking with God, it'd probably be that right there. And we struggle with them. We may not have statues in our bathrooms or a little cabinet. That might not be it for us, but it's something. It's ourself or a relationship or a kid or a parent or a football team. We have them. What is it for you? And how can you beg God to rip it away from you? So ultimately, it will be healthier if you do. His failure was one of worship, but then his son takes his seat. It's interesting, 12:1, he goes to this place called Shechem. Rehoboam goes to Shechem, and all Israel gathers around him there to make him their new king. This is still one kingdom at this point. Solomon's dead, but there's still one group of people. And Rehoboam, the son of Solomon, goes to take his seat. And they meet at Shechem. We've seen that before. That's the place, when we began this series, we talked about Joshua 24, where Joshua gathers all the people together and he says, you choose this day who you're going to serve. Me? God? Or other gods? Make a decision. And he did that at Shechem. And it's this same place that Rehoboam goes back to and brings the people together to ceremonially say, who will we serve? And remind them again who they belong to. They are not their own. Neither are we. He brings them there. They gather around and they say to him, your father made our yoke heavy. Now lighten the hard service of your father and his heavy yoke on us, and we will serve you. And he tells them, okay, I'll tell you what, go away. Come back in 3 days and I'll tell you what I'm going to do as king. And Rehoboam gathers around two different groups of people. It says he's gathered with the old men and the young men. The old men tell him, you know what, here's what you need to do. You need to say to the people, verse 7, if you will be a servant to this people, what we just say one of the roles of the king of Israel was, that was to be different from everyone else, was to be a servant. To be gentle, to be kind, and to point them to the one who could ultimately rule them. If you will be a servant to this people today and serve them and speak good words to them when you answer them, then they will be your servants forever. If you will be gentle, if you will be kind, if you will be a good and wise ruler, this is what you need to do. He gathers the young men, and they tell him to say, And there's a embellishment, I think, in the translation. The Hebrew says, my little one is thicker than my father's thighs. That's the Hebrews. It's talking about power. That's what it is. He's not the first leader, and he won't be the last. Lyndon Johnson is famous for making these kind of references to talk about his power. He says, whereas my father laid on you a heavy yoke, I will add to your yoke. My father disciplined you with whips, but I will discipline you with scorpions. I'm going to show them who's boss. You think you had it bad. Now, I think this is probably one of the saddest moments in the history of Israel. I think it's tragic because you have a man who was supposed to be king, given a choice between being a good king, a kind king, and serving the people that he's called to rule, or lording it over them and grinding them into the dust, and he chooses the latter, to grind them into the dust. And that's what he goes back and tells them. You think you had it bad, you just wait. His failure was one of leadership. Terrible, terrible choice, because he should have chosen to be a good king. How often do we fail in that area of leadership? Either for fear, maybe we're just afraid somebody's going to take our position. And some of us, I just need to back up for a second, because I hear this sometimes, well, we're not all leaders. And I hear, well, none of us are called to be leaders. Jesus is the only leader. And I wouldn't totally disagree with that, but here's the problem. all of us are called into the lives of somebody where our job is to say, look at the leader. Look at the king. Look at what the king is to you, what he can be. We are supposed to lead somebody in our families. Maybe we need to gather around us a group of people. I once heard somebody say that every Christian needs a Paul, a Barnabas, and a Timothy. We need somebody above us speaking into our life. We need somebody beside us that we can sort of do life with. And we need somebody under us, younger than us, who we are coaching in the faith. I think that right there would be a huge success in leadership if we could do that. And then there's this division. The people gather and they say, well, what part do we have then in David, in Israel? We're not a part of this project anymore. And they split up, and 10 go one way and 2 go another. And Jeroboam comes in, and war breaks out between these groups of people. And finally God intervenes and says, oh, don't fight. Just go back to your places. And now, and this does make sense, for a long time, and nobody told me this in church, and I think it helps. One of the reasons I do these kinds of things is I want you guys to be able to use this book. I want you to be able to understand it. I really do. I want you to be able to read it on a Monday morning and go, oh yeah, this makes sense to me. Because I know, I get it. I spent months trying to figure out stories that this right here makes sense of. Because throughout a lot of the Old Testament, you'll be told, if you're reading, this was the king of Israel, this was the king of Judah, and you're like, who are these people, right? Well, this is where it all starts. David and Solomon were the only kings of a unified Israel. Then there's a division, and you have Israel, which is the 10 tribes, and you have Judah, which is 2. That's what happened. So as you're reading that, keep that in mind. I want this stuff to really... If you can't apply it tomorrow morning in life, maybe you can apply it tomorrow morning when you're just reading. It'll make a little more sense. So war breaks out. Jeroboam goes, guess where, to Shechem to establish his kingdom, his throne, his capital city, and Rehoboam goes to Jerusalem. And then, another failure. Jeroboam, verse 12:26. Jeroboam said in his heart, now the kingdom will turn back to the house of David. He's afraid. He's afraid of losing his authority and his power. If this people go up to offer sacrifices in the temple of the Lord at Jerusalem, remember, that's what this whole thing's about, that God would be worshipped at this place together. And the heart of this people will turn again to their Lord. Who's their Lord? He says to Rehoboam, king of Judah. And they will kill me. And they will return to Rehoboam. So the king took counsel and made 2 calves of gold. And he said to this people, you have gone up to Jerusalem long enough. Listen for this. It's going to be familiar. Behold your gods, O Israel, who brought you up out of Egypt. We just read that a couple of weeks ago. We studied a passage where the people in the desert make a golden calf and they say these exact same words. Why does he do that? You know, I spent a lot of time in the mid-90s in what had been the USSR as a missionary. And as I talked to people about God and the gospel and this kind of thing, one of the things I was struck by was, and truly, if you've ever been there, and I know some of you have, you will know this. I would say on every street corner, but it's more frequent than this. There is some statue or some memorial honoring the great government of the Soviet Union. I'm sure many of those have probably been taken down by now, but they were everywhere. And I remember thinking, I know why. Because people must have something to worship. And if you don't want them to worship God, you give them something else. And that's what he did. For his own pride, his own security. His first failure was one of worship. He failed in the area of worship, and his second failure was in leadership. He chose himself over the people that he was called to serve. We need to be thinking about these things. We need to struggle with this. Why is all of this important for you and me? I mean, what's the point? Well, you know, Andrew Peterson, I like his phrase, and I'm sure he probably got this from somebody else, said that this Bible, the whole thing, is the true tall tale of the coming of the King. That there are these tall tales that we tell. Get all my tales in there. These tall tales that we tell to one another to encourage, lift up, point, remind, right? That we have sometimes, maybe even teach. I mean, we all know the story of the grasshopper and the ant because we're German. We know what that's about. We know we're supposed to store up for the winter. And that's what we learn from the story. These stories are similar. They're given to us so that we know how to respond and how to live and what kinds of choices to make as a result. And as Chesterton famously said, children don't have fairy tales to teach them that dragons exist. Children already know that dragons exist. They need fairy tales to teach them that dragons can be killed. I think we're the same way. The first, probably, definitely, the most important thing that you and I can get from seeing these stories is that in all of this, through all of this, God doesn't give up on his people. Right here, yet again, as we've watched this covenant story unfold, we see a tremendous failure. One that any one of us would probably go, you know what, I am done. I can't keep doing this. And God doesn't give up. You might be here, and you might bring in some kind of baggage or something in your story, or you know, maybe somebody drug you here, and there's still something in your baggage, something in your story that makes you feel like there's just no more hope for me after what I did. God certainly is done with me. God doesn't give up on his people. When we baptize, we mark you as one of his. And he does not give up on his. If he did, he'd have done it here. He even promises them here in this that I will set it right. This will not be forever. What he said to Solomon. I don't remember the verse. I'm going to take it away. I will bring restoration. He always does. Another thing we learn is the significance and the importance of worship. Worshiping God. Our hearts are made to worship. We will worship whatever we can. And often, trust me, I find this out sitting in my office. Often, we begin just a little bit to worship something else. We find them. We'll find what works for us. And we'll worship it. And what that something else does is slowly and gradually push our Creator to the side. Until pretty soon, I just really need to sleep in on Sunday. And that other thing on Monday morning begins to take even more space. We must put our priority on worship of the one God. And then also the importance of leadership. I think it's worth asking, who is in your life that God is calling you to point toward Jesus? And how are you doing at it? Are you pointing at yourself? I am guilty often of saying, hey, look at me. But I should only do that to the extent that Paul did it when he said, follow me as I follow Christ. I am nothing special. None of us are. But what we are is in the life of somebody and able to point them toward Jesus. Who is that? And how are you doing at it? Here's the point. We are people who fall down. We fall down regularly. We fall down often. Don't try to pretend you're not. Yet, it is God and God alone that picks us up and he dusts us off and he sets us on a path. All we've got to do is walk on that path in order to give him glory and live the life we were made to live. Let me pray for us. God, thank you for these stories. Thank you that you give them to us. You didn't give us a book of moral perfection, but rather a set of stories pointing to the only one who is morally perfect. Help us to rest in you, Jesus. Help us to hope in you. Help us to trust. Remind us of your grace when we easily forget. Amen.